cracked wall of the terminal. He waits for the shower of raining glass. But now his feet are on the pavement outside, and the pavement is a shadowy purple in the growing cast of daylight. His sneakers are blue there. Only two people wait in front of them to board the bus. Only one. Mami pushes him on ahead of her, and then she's there, too, glued to his backpack, propelling him down the aisle past extruding knees and elbows. And when he collapses into the seat against the soft fabric of the cushions, and Mami plops down next to him, he feels more grateful and relieved than he ever has in his entire life. "We made it," he says quietly. Mami opens her lips without moving her teeth. She doesn't look relieved.
"Okay, mijo," she says.
She pulls his head onto her lap and strokes his hair until, as their bus rambles north onto the Viaducto Diamante and gathers speed, he falls asleep. Chapter 7. It's a victory to get out of Acapulco alive, Lydia notices. Yes, they've cleared the first significant hurdle. She'd like to feel her son's surge of relieved optimism, but she knows too much about the reach and determination of Los Jardineros and their jefe to experience any real respite from her fear. She stares out the window and keeps her head low. In the early days of their marriage, Lydia and Sebastián took frequent weekend trips to Mexico City, trading cities with the tourists. They'd both gone to college there. It was where they met, and though neither of them had any desire to live in the capital, they enjoyed being close enough to visit. In those days, the state of Guerrero felt safe, insulated. Their country had its share of narcotraficantes back then, but they felt as distant as Hollywood or Al-Qaeda. The violence would erupt in concentrated, faraway bursts. First, Ciudad Juárez, then Sinaloa, then Michoacán. Acapulco, ringed by mountains and sea, retained its sunny bubble of protective tourism. The salty ocean air, the wheeling calls of the seagulls, the big sunglasses, the wind whipping down the boulevard to toss the ladies' hair around their sun-brown faces. It all intensified that swollen illusion of immunity. It typically took Lydia and Sebastián just over 4 hours to drive from Acapulco to Mexico City in their orange Beetle, because Sebastián sped like a lunatic around the gentle mountain curves, up and down the scenic slopes of the highway. Even though his driving was questionable, the road was broad and smooth. Lydia looked out over the landscape at the sunshine leaning between the distant peaks, the terraces of clouds stepping down toward the irregular earth, the rooftops and steeples of the fleeting villages. And she felt safe with her new husband in their little orange car. At Chilpancingo, they often stopped for a coffee or a sandwich. Sometimes they met with friends. Sebastián's college roommate lived there with his wife and the baby who became Sebastián's godson. And then a couple hours later, in Mexico City, they'd find a cheap hotel and walk the city for hours. Museums, shows, restaurants, dancing, window shopping, the Bosque de Chapultepec. Or sometimes they wouldn't leave their hotel room at all. And Sebastián, sweaty, laughing, tangled in the sheets, would whisper into his wife's hair that they could have stayed in Acapulco and saved some money. Lydia tips her head back against the bus seat behind her. It's inconceivable that those memories are from 10 years ago. Inconceivable that Sebastián is really gone. She feels a monstrous lurch inside her, so she reaches out to touch the soft curve of Luca's sleeping ear. Everything devolved so rapidly in recent years. Acapulco always had a heart for extravagance, so when at last she made her fall from grace, she did so with all the spectacular pageantry the world had come to expect of her. The cartels painted the town red. As their bus passes the crooked shoulders of trees and a scar of blasted rock face where the road cuts through the countryside, Lydia notes that they've already reached Ocotito. She prays there will be no roadblock between here and Mexico City, but she knows that's impossible. Even before Acapulco fell, the roadblocks around Guerrero, as in much of the country, had become a menace. They're manned by gangs or narcotraficantes or police, who may also be narcotraficantes, or soldiers, who may also be narcotraficantes, or in recent years, by autodefensas, armed militias formed by the inhabitants of certain towns to protect their communities from cartels. And these autodefensas may also, of course, be narcotraficantes. In character, the roadblocks range from inconvenient to life-threatening. It's because of the existence of the more serious ones that Lydia and Sebastian stopped traveling regularly to the capital shortly after Luca was born. The reason Luca has been to Mexico City only once before, when he was too young to remember it. And the reason Lydia allowed her driver's license to expire almost 2 years ago. They seldom left Acapulco now. And Lydia, like most women in Mexico's more precarious states, never travels alone by car anymore. This truth has felt like a growing but theoretical irritation to Lydia over the last couple of years, and affront to her contemporary feminine autonomy. But today, it feels like a very real noose around her neck. She may have managed their escape from Acapulco for now, but she knows they're still trapped in Guerrero State. And she can feel the roadblocks all around the periphery of her mind closing in on them. Without waking Luca, Lydia spreads out the map and pins it with one hand to the seat in front of her. She studies the spreading veins of the roadways and feels the ticking futility of that action. If only their bodies could pass unimpeded along these highways as quickly and safely as her finger traces the route along the map. If the roadblocks were represented on the map key, their icon might be a tiny AK-47. But they're not on the map, because they're always moving to maintain the element of surprise. Lydia knows that every road between here and Mexico City will have at least one roadblock occupied by Los Jardineros. She knows that the boys manning those roadblocks will be looking specifically for her and for Luca. She imagines that some of those boys are both ambitious and violent, that they'll be eager to recognize her. She wonders what reward they might receive for delivering her, either whole or in pieces, to her friend. Lydia tries to refold the map along its previous creases, but her patience is flimsy, and she shoves it into the pocket of the seat in front of her. She tries to think clearly, to review their options. Most people she would ordinarily turn to for help are dead. And even if they weren't, asking for help is akin to walking into a friend's kitchen wearing a suicide vest. The risk of her very presence seems too selfish to consider. Although she's aware that Chilpancingo is crawling with jardineros, she also knows that if they hope to avoid a roadblock, they will have to get off there. Boarding this bus felt like a tremendous victory only a few minutes ago, but maybe it was a mistake. Maybe they're speeding into a trap. She watches Luca, the rise and fall of his chest as he sleeps, and she attempts to match the rhythm of his breath. When she was a kid, Lydia loved the Choose Your Own Adventure books. At the end of each chapter, you'd have to decide what to do next. Ride your bike to the park? Flip to page 23. Follow the mysterious stranger. Flip to page 42. Whenever Lydia didn't like the outcome of her plot, or sometimes even when she did, she would backtrack and make a different choice. She liked being able to revise her own decisions, liked knowing that nothing was permanent, that she could always start over and try again. But it was also true that sometimes it didn't matter. The maze of the book seemed to funnel her back to the same result, no matter what she decided. This morning, she and Luca had selected the 6:20 a.m. bus from Diamante, and now it's traveling north without delay. She closes her eyes and prays it was the right choice. Luca wakes up as the bus approaches Chilpancingo. Lydia can't see much from their seats halfway back, but she tries. She leans into the aisle and looks for a roadblock ahead. Luca leans his forehead against the window and presses his finger against the smudgy glass.
Mommy, look, he yawns. What are they?
On a ridge above them, rows of colorful houses snake up the hillside, all in matching clusters. Red, blue, green, purple.
Oh, they're just houses, amorcito.
Only houses? It's turned into a bright young morning. They've been on the road almost 2 hours.
Why are they so colorful like that?
Just for decoration, I think.
They look like Legos.
Lydia's breath hitches in her chest every time the bus jerks or turns or changes its speed. But there's no stopping. No armed men standing in the road. And soon, buildings line both sides of the narrow street, and they've made it. They're in Chilpancingo. She makes the sign of the cross over herself and traces a smaller version on Luca's forehead. They pull up in front of a familiar building, a miniature of the station they embarked from in Acapulco this morning. The driver stops the bus, and there's the loud hiccuping noise as he engages the brakes. He stands and announces past his mustache,
5 minute stop.
A couple passengers stand up from their seats to stretch. At the front, someone gets off for a cigarette, but Lydia and Luca are the only ones who begin gathering their things to disembark. Everyone on board is heading to the capital.
Are we getting out, mommy?
Yes, mi amor.
But then she stands next to her seat in the narrow aisle with her backpack strapped to her shoulders and looks down at her sleepy son, at the top of his tousled black head, and she wishes they could make a run for it. She wishes they could hunker down in here, camouflaged among the travelers on this bus, and hold their breath all the way to Mexico City. Maybe they'd make it. Maybe the roadblock between here and there would be innocuous. A brief stop, a fistful of bills, a languorous waving through. Thump, thump. 2 slaps on the side of the bus as it rolls on its merry way. Lydia imagines it all with a quiver of hope. The bus driver emerges from the terminal now and gets back on the bus. New passengers begin to board, and the driver takes their tickets one by one.
Mommy, come on.
As the shadow of the bus pulls away from the sidewalk, Lydia and Luca emerge into the blinking daylight of Chilpancingo. She feels both relieved and disheartened to be off the bus, but she takes a moment to remind herself that she's managed to get them this far, 19 hours and 68 miles away from the epicenter of calamity. With each minute and mile that passes, Lydia knows she's increased their chances of survival. She needs to take encouragement where she can find it. She mustn't despair at the enormity of the task yet ahead. She should focus only on the immediate next steps. Find Sebastian's college roommate. On the sidewalk, she tightens the straps on Luca's backpack, which are drooping too far from his small shoulders. He looks like a turtle with an inadequate shell. Yet somehow he's managed to draw his most vulnerable parts tightly within himself. She wonders about the lasting effects of that retraction.
What's next, mommy?
Luca asks her in the flat tone of voice that seems to be his only inflection now.
Let's find an internet cafe, she says. But you have papi's tablet, right?
It's powered off in her backpack, and she's not going to turn it back on. She also left the SIM card of her own cell phone in a garbage can outside the bank in Playa Caletilla. She felt marginally crazy,
paranoid, as she pried the thing out with her fingernail, but she didn't want to be a blue dot flashing on some remote, hostile screen. She adjusts the brim of Sebastian's Yankees cap, slightly lower on her son's forehead. She should buy one for herself, too, she thinks.
Let's go, she says.
El Cascabelito Internet Cafe is just opening for the day when Lydia purchases a coffee and 15 minutes to look more closely at maps online. She buys Luca a bag of platanitos, too, but the green foil package sits unopened on the desk. Lydia chooses a computer in the back corner, one that has two chairs and a privacy partition so they're hidden from view of the door. Luca draws his heels up to the seat of the chair and rests his chin on his knees, but his eyes remain unfocused on the platanitos while Lydia studies the screen. From Chilpancingo, there are only two viable routes to Mexico City, and both are virtually guaranteed to have roadblocks. Lydia chews the inside of her mouth, and her knee undertakes a jittery hop beneath the desk. They can't exactly walk to Mexico City from here. Lydia's never been claustrophobic, but today she feels so trapped. She can feel it in her limbs, a panicky longing to stretch. She can't see any way out. Dismay will not help. She opens Facebook and finds Sebastian's friend. He's an attorney, and his profile shows the name of his law firm, but it's Sunday and it won't be open. She checks his About tab and scrolls down to his likes. A local newspaper, a couple nonprofits, his alma mater, a fan page for Adidas sneakers. So much football. But then, there, bingo, a Pentecostal church here in Chilpancingo. A worship service at 9 o'clock. She looks it up and finds it's about 2 miles away. There's a bus down the main thoroughfare, and 20 minutes later, Luca and Lydia are on it. Lydia worries she wrote the address down wrong, because when they get off the bus, the street is lined with shops, all closed on a Sunday morning. They find the number they're looking for sandwiched between an electronics store and a jeweler. But just as she's double-checking the address on the scrap of paper in her hand, a young man pushing a baby carriage approaches and opens the door for his pregnant wife. Lydia peeks inside before the door swings closed, and she sees rows of folding chairs facing a stage. Luca tugs on her sleeve and directs her attention to a sign she hadn't noticed, propped in the window. Iglesia Pentecostal Tabernáculo de la Victoria. There's no steeple or stained glass, but this is the place. Inside, it's bigger than she imagined, with low ceilings and fans attached to the walls. There's a full drum kit, an amplifier, and some huge speakers set up behind the pulpit. There's no cross, no font of holy water at the entrance, but Lydia blesses herself out of habit, and Luca follows her example. She waits for some bubble of feeling to follow, a whisper from her legion of newborn angels, or perhaps a low-down rage at God instead. But nothing comes. It's spiritual tumbleweed, un desierto del alma, because she has room only for fear. They sit in the last row near the wall, and Lydia stows their backpacks under their folding chairs. She covers her face with her hands and instructs Luca to do the same, but it's not veneration. It's only for concealment, in case any of los jardineros are Pentecostal Christians, in case they traffic drugs on a Monday, stab people on a Thursday, and then come here seeking forgiveness on a Sunday. It doesn't seem more outlandish than anything else that's happened. Through the screen of her interlaced fingers, Lydia watches the square of stark sunlight on the tiled floor grow brighter every time someone opens the glass door to come in. A few of the congregants notice them in the back row and give them a welcoming nod or a smile, but most walk right past and find their usual seats. The church is almost half full by the time Carlos appears behind his wife and children. The wife greets everyone with hugs and has the sharp voice of a gabacha above the hum of reverent conversation in the room. Lydia half stands from her seat and lifts a hand in greeting, but Carlos doesn't see her. The youngest son alerts him, points to Lydia in the corner, and Carlos turns.
Lydia, oh my goodness, what are you doing here?
His voice arrives before he does, but soon he maneuvers himself between the rows of chairs to where she's standing. He embraces her. It's so lovely to see you. Wow, what a surprise. Luca watches while this man, Carlos, kisses Mami on both cheeks and holds both her hands in his.
This must be Luca,
the man says, bending toward him where he's still seated on the folding chair.
You look so much like your papi.
He straightens up.
Where's Sebastian? Did he come with you?
You haven't heard the news.
Mami's voice sounds far away. Luca can tell without having to look that Carlos's face has suddenly shifted, that it's drained to a sickly gray, that he's already building the internal fortifications he'll need in order to hold the horrific story Mami's about to tell him.
Come, Carlos says. We can talk upstairs.
There's an office there, and it's not quite accurate to say that Luca zones out while his mother and Carlos talk, because that description would indicate some active participation of abstention on his part. Instead, his consciousness, like a helium balloon fastened to his person by some taut and fragile string, momentarily floats away. His body sits at a table with his backpack at his feet. His legs swivel the chair beneath his weight. His hands play with a nearby dish of paper clips, hooking them together into long strands, but his internal mappings are on vacation. The grown-ups glance at him now and again, past the barricades of their warbled voices and ashen faces, and his body responds to their questions with the appropriate nods or shrugs. A paper cup of water is set on the table before him, and he takes a dutiful sip. Downstairs, someone is playing the drums. An electric guitar. Luca can feel the bass vibrating through the floor. Then they're in Carlos's car, and they're driving through the streets of the city to Carlos's house. Mami sits in the back seat and tries to hold Luca's hand. He sees this, sees Mami's hand covering his own, and it's the warmth and press of her fingers that bring him back. Once they pass out of La Zona Centro, Luca sees that Chilpancingo isn't so different from Acapulco. There are no seagulls here, no tourists, and the streets aren't as broad. But there are many colorful shops and taxis, people wearing their church clothes in the sunshine. There are ladies with handbags slung over their shoulders, boys with slipshod tattoos, plenty of bright, foamy graffiti. The houses are all painted in vivid colors. Luca watches them flip by like cards in a deck. After 3.5 songs have played on the radio, Carlos turns onto a street that's slightly wider than the others. There's an arching canopy of shade trees that creates the sense of entering a secret place, a hushy hideout. In the middle of the block stands a handsome white church with modest twin bell towers at the front. It's the kind they're used to, Católica. The other buildings on the crowded street stand back from the little church, giving it room. Carlos pulls into a parking spot. Carlos's house is turquoise, the exact color of the middle stripe of the ocean in Acapulco, in between the light sandy stripe near the shore and the darker blue at the horizon when you stand on the steps at Plaza España and look out on a sunny day. The house feels big and modern, even though it's attached to an identical purple one on the right and an identical peach-colored one on the left. Carlos carries their bags inside. Carlos's wife is named Meredith, and she's white. She's from Estados Unidos, and that's a fact Luca could have gathered without being told, just from the quick glimpse he got of her in church before Carlos took them upstairs. Her voice, her clothes, her way of holding people by the shoulders and shaking them slightly while she speaks to them. Luca investigates the empty house, the family photographs, a closer look at the three boys, who all have Meredith's pink complexion and Carlos's dimples. The middle one looks about the same age as Luca. Meredith eventually arrives home without those boys, who stayed behind for even more church. And with her comes Luca's first experience of proprietary grief. Proprietary is a word Luca knows, in Spanish, but not in English, because he knows lots of words other eight-year-olds don't, like viscous and bombastic and serendipity. But he's never truly understood the meaning of the word propietario until now. He's never felt the feeling before. It rumbles through him like a steamroller with a broad, flattening crush. Because who is this woman crying for papi? Who is this lady with her quivering features and her leaking eyes and her trembling hands and her need to be consoled? It surprises Luca, his ungenerous interpretation of such raw emotion. After all, she'd been papi's friend at one time. Or at least she married papi's friend. And she'd liked papi well enough to make him the godfather to her eldest son. So why shouldn't she be saddened, even traumatized, by the news of his unexpected and violent death? Why shouldn't she weep and lament and exhibit her devastation? Luca cannot, therefore, explain why the display of it irritates him so. When she tries to hug him, he can't endure it, and mommy doesn't make him. She intercepts him and takes him to the bathroom and splashes water on his face. And when they return, Meredith has composed herself. She urges mommy to sit while she makes tea for everyone. The tea doesn't move from the cups, but the conversation goes on for a long time regardless, and Luca lets most of it pass him without landing. Meredith met Carlos when she was a college-aged missionary from Indiana, and she's still involved with that faraway cornfield church. That summer she first came here, she fell in love with Carlos and with his country. She liked the way Mexicans were easy in their faith. She liked the sense of being in a country where it wasn't controversial or weird to talk openly about God. In Mexico, prayer was normal then, public, expected. To Meredith, those cultural conventions felt miraculous. So she and Carlos married young, and then she made it her life's work to preserve the link between Chilpancingo and that Indiana church community, to share the experience of this place with others. In fact, right now there are 14 Indiana missionaries visiting here for spring break. Those missionaries are being hosted in Chilpancingo by the church Carlos and Meredith attend. Meredith is the chief coordinator of this annual visit, and two additional ones each summer. It's a nonstop wheel of blonde Indiana missionaries cogging their way through Guerrero. The current group will fly home to Estados Unidos Wednesday afternoon. So the church's three passenger vans are scheduled to depart for Mexico City at 7 o'clock Wednesday morning. This is where the conversation takes on amplified urgency. Luca sits up in his chair and fiddles with the handle of mommy's teacup. Carlos says, "They can go in the shuttle, of course. It's perfect." Meredith says nothing with her mouth, but conveys plenty with her eyes, and none of it is very accommodating. And then mommy says, "We'd be safe getting through the roadblocks if we were on the church shuttle." "They'd never expect you to be with the missionaries," Carlos says. Mommy shakes her head. "They wouldn't even look." And then Meredith uses her mouth. "Safe for who? Maybe safer for you, but I'm sorry. I can't put all those kids at risk." She shakes her head, and Luca has the notion that she looks nothing like the woman who was crying for papi just a few minutes ago.
She's different colors entirely, and her spongy features have hardened into new shapes. Mami opens her mouth but manages to close it again without speaking. She fidgets with the loops of gold at her neck. Carlos taps his pointer finger on the table between them. They all look at that finger. Meredith, there's no other option for them. I understand your concern, but this is the only way to get them safely out of Guerrero. If we don't help them, they could die.
Could is an understatement, Mami says.
But Meredith crosses her arms and shakes her head some more. Her hair is some color between brown and gold, and it's pushed back from her face with a black headband. Her nose is red, cheeks red, eyes hard blue. Mami lifts her teacup and tries a sip, but when she sets it back down, Luca can tell she didn't swallow any.
I'm sorry, it's too risky, Meredith says. It's not fair to do that to the kids, to their parents in Indiana. This is exactly the kind of thing those families fear, sending their kids down here to Mexico. Do you have any idea what it takes to placate those fears? We give them our word their kids will be safe. I personally guarantee their safety. I tell them this kind of thing will never happen.
Mami clears her throat, and her face looks like a bomba about to go off, but she breathes through it.
This kind of thing.
Meredith presses her eyes closed.
I'm sorry. I don't even know what to say.
Sebastian is dead, Meredith, Carlos says. My friend, your friend, he's gone, and 15 more besides. This is not the kind of thing that happens ever, not even here. Do you know anyone else who's lost 16 family members in one day?
Meredith glares at him, but he plows ahead.
We have to help them. If the suffering of our friends means nothing, if those kids can't be allowed to see us, to see Mexico as it really is, then what are they even doing here? Are they just drive-by Samaritans? Carlos, don't, Meredith says,
and Luca has the feeling this is a very old conversation between them.
They just want to make pancakes and take selfies with skinny brown children, Carlos asks.
Meredith slaps her hand against the table, and the tea ripples in the cups. But Mami intercepts a rising anger between them. She speaks like a void, like she's left the conversation entirely, and only her voice remains behind. She chants without any expression.
Sebastian, Yemi, Alex, Jennifer, Adrián, Paula, Arturo, Stephanie, Nico, Joaquín, Diana, Vicente, Rafael, Lucia, and Rafaelito. Mama, they are gone. All gone.
A lump rises in Luca's throat and grows one size with each name that leaves Mami's mouth. He looks at Meredith to see how she'll respond, but her face is an unreadable smear of pink and blue. Instead, it's Carlos who replies, placing his hands flat on the table.
We will help you, he whispers. Of course we will.
Meredith stands to pace behind her chair, her arms crossed in front of her.
Lydia, I can't pretend to know what you're going through. It's unimaginable. And yes, of course we'll do everything in our power to help, but please try to understand. I also have to weigh my moral responsibility here. Sometimes there are no easy answers.
Mami tends her hands over her forehead.
I don't want to cause trouble for anyone. I just want to get Luca out of here. I have to.
For the first time since all this started, Luca thinks she might unravel. He watches intensely, and her voice cracks.
Please. We're desperate.
Carlos looks up at his wife.
Honey, listen, I understand your resistance, I do. But sometimes there are easy answers. This is an easy answer. If we don't help them, if they get on a bus alone, if they get stopped at a roadblock and killed because we didn't have the courage to save them, can you live with that? Can we?
Meredith sighs and leans over the back of her chair.
I don't know. I don't know.
Just pray on it, he says. Give it up to God.
She turns and clicks on the electric kettle, even though no one has yet managed to choke down the first cup of tea. With her back to the table, she says, Are you sure they're even looking for you now? She faces the table again and leans against the counter. Wasn't Sebastian the example they wanted? They got him, so maybe it's over now.
Luca looks from Meredith back to Mami, and she meets his gaze and pauses, as if weighing how much to say in front of him. Perhaps she remembers that fear is good for him now. He should be afraid.
No, Mami says quietly. He won't stop until he finds us.
Chapter 8. In bed, on the night she discovered that Javier and La Lechuza were the same person, Lydia turned off the lamp but did not close her eyes. She and Sebastian had always agreed that married people were entitled to a certain measure of privacy, that they needn't tell each other everything. It was one of the reasons she'd fallen in love with him. He didn't press her on personal matters. He was seldom jealous, and he had no interest in annexing or directing her friendships with other men.
You're a person, an adult, he said to her before they were engaged, and I'm your lover. If we get married, you choose me. I hope you'll continue to choose me every day.
Lydia had laughed at his unfashionable use of the word lover, but the sentiment thrilled her. Before Sebastian, she'd always presumed that marriage would entail a sacrifice of her liberty. That it had not delighted her. They were both trustworthy, and they fancied themselves quite modern. They kept nothing of import from each other, but Lydia liked having a sacred cupboard within herself, to which only she was allowed access. So there'd been nothing untoward in her failure to mention the name Javier to her husband before. But, of course, that night, everything changed. When Sebastian got up in the morning and kissed her forehead on his way to the bathroom, she was still awake. She sat up in bed, her stomach lurching with the movement.
Sebastian, she said. She thought about not telling him, about asking questions instead.
She knew that once the words were out of her mouth, her friendship with Javier would come to an end, and beneath everything else, there was a foundation of grief to that impending loss. She wanted her discovery to be untrue, a misunderstanding. Her husband turned toward her in the gray light of the bedroom.
What's wrong?
He knew instantly from the pitch of her voice. He crossed the space between them and sat beside her on the bed.
He's my friend, she confessed.
Sebastian didn't go to work that morning. He called his editor and left a message that he was following a lead and wouldn't be in until later. He and Lydia sat together on the unmade bed and talked for hours, while outside the light shifted from gray to pink to broad, sunny yellow. When it was time to wake Luca and take him to school, they managed the routine in a distracted haze.
I'll take him today, Sebastian insisted. You wait here.
Lydia cried in the shower. When Sebastian returned, they continued their discussion at the kitchen table. Lydia's wet hair was knotted on top of her head, and her face felt blotchy.
Is there any chance you're mistaken? She asked, her arms folded in front of her.
She already knew the answer, but it made no sense. She was floundering. Sebastian locked his eyes on her and answered in the most deliberate possible tone.
No.
She nodded. The piece you're working on about Los Jardineros, does it specifically mention him?
Yes, it's all about him, his big debut. The whole, hello world, I'm a major kingpin, expose.
Lydia tilted her head to one side, placed her hand against her forehead.
I don't know what to do, she whispered. It seems impossible.
There's nothing to do, Lydia.
But I just can't understand it. I know him.
I know, Lydia, I know. How charming he can be, how erudite. But he's also incredibly dangerous.
She pictured Javier's eyes, how exposed they look whenever he removed his glasses. That word, dangerous, seems so incompatible.
I know it's difficult to get your head around it, Sebastian said. I can see you're struggling, and I am sorry.
He paused before he shifted gears.
But he's a murderer, Lydia. Many times over, this guy is made of blood. This guy.
She shook her head again. Sebastian stood up and placed his hands on the back of his chair. He pushed it under the table.
He's not who you thought he was.
But you said yourself, just last night, that he, that Los Jardineros, they aren't as violent as the other cartels.
He had said that, damn it.
Lydia opened the kitchen window to the noise of the traffic below. Lydia, I love you. I love your loyalty and your goodness. But we are talking degrees of murderers here. Less violent or not, he's still a major narco. And when you've killed that many people, killing becomes conventional. Does it matter that he's killed fewer children than other murderers have? It's not a moderation born of virtue. It's a pinche business decision. That guy would kill anyone if he thought it was the smart thing to do.
Not anyone.
Her voice was a weakening plea.
He has a daughter.
Sebastian dropped his head between his outstretched arms.
Sebastian, listen, she said. I know it all sounds absurd, but I'm not naive. I am not an idiot, right?
You're the smartest woman I know.
So I'm trying to take it all in, to reconcile everything you're telling me, and to make it match up with the person I know Javier to be.
I know. I know.
It's difficult.
I can't imagine.
Because I do, Sebastian. I know him. And like you say, he is smart. In a different life, he could have been someone good.
But it's not a different life, Lydia. He's not someone good.
But maybe he still could be. That's what I'm telling you, because people are complex, and whatever you say he is, he's also this other person, this tortured, poetic soul full of remorse. He's funny. He's kind. Maybe things could still be different.
Wait. Sebastian surveyed his wife, who was now leaning against the kitchen windowsill. Outside, a horn blared, and a breeze moved past a drying tendril of her hair.
Wait a second, Lydia. Are you in love with him?
What?
Are you?
Sebastian, don't be ridiculous. This is no time for histrionics.
He shook his head.
But do you have feelings for him?
No, not like that. I do love him.
You love him?
He's my friend, a real friend, someone who's become very important to me.
She leaned her hands on her knees and looked up at him. The coffee maker gurgled and sighed. His father died of cancer, too. Her husband pulled the chair back out and sat down again.
Oh, Lydia.
Sebastian had never met Lydia's father, but his death was such a defining loss in Lydia's life, and indeed in Sebastian and Lydia's early courtship, that he felt a strong kinship to his deceased father-in-law, nonetheless. He knew all the stories. How, when Lydia was 12 years old, slightly too old for teddy bears, her lifelong favorite developed a gash in its nose. Lydia was heartbroken and embarrassed. The bear hemorrhaged his stuffing all over the house. Lydia's father went quietly to the pharmacy and returned with a bag that he placed on their kitchen table beneath a swing arm lamp. He instructed her to bring the bear from her room. She transported the bear with great care, and when she returned to the kitchen, it had been transformed into an operating room. There was a sheet of plastic spread out across a table. Her father wore a mask and rubber gloves. His surgical tools were spread out beneath the lamp. Needle, thread, a gleaming swatch of new leather. Lydia's father crafted an entirely new leather nose for her bear. Sebastian knew, too, that the only green vegetable his father-in-law ate was lima beans, that he had a 3-inch scar on his leg from a childhood boating accident, that he sang loudly at concerts and sometimes in mortifying harmony with whichever act was on stage. Sebastian knew that the only time Lydia had ever seen her father cry was when Oscar de la Hoya won the gold medal round at the 1992 Olympics in Barcelona. Sebastian felt such a fondness for his father-in-law that he wondered if he knew the man better in death than he would have in life. They'd been dating only 8 weeks and were at the Estadio Azul in Mexico City attending a football match when Lydia got that terrible phone call. Though the cancer had been slow, the end had been fast, unexpected. It was October 24th, 2003. Exactly 1 week before El Día de los Muertos. Reportedly, his last words had been, "There's a party. I have to prepare." Lydia and Sebastian left the stadium immediately, and he drove her first to her apartment and then, through the night, back to Acapulco. Her clothes were in heaps in the back seat. She couldn't think what she was supposed to bring, so she brought everything. She packed in a laundry basket. Sebastian held her hand in the dark and stopped on the side of the road near Cuernavaca when she thought she might throw up. He drove back and forth to Mexico City 3 more times that week. The next day, to retrieve his own clothes. 2 days later, to inform Lydia's professors and his own about their absences. And finally, to bring some of her friends down for the funeral and to join Lydia's mother in convincing Lydia to return to college. In some way, Sebastian always credited that tragedy with being the thing that cemented their relationship. They had already known they were falling in love, and then the gravity of that heartbreak acted like a measuring stick for Lydia. It calculated the depth of Sebastian's character. The death aroused an unfamiliar stability in Sebastian. He found himself expanding in an effort to plug the holes in Lydia's life. So he understood when she said this simple thing about Javier, that his father died of cancer too. Sebastian understood the scope of what that shared experience really meant to his wife. "How old was he?" Sebastian asked, "when his father died." 11, she said. Sebastian grimaced. "Terrible." Lydia went to the cupboard and took down 2 mugs, which she filled with coffee. She set one in front of her husband and sat down beside him once again. She drew her knees up and wrapped her arms around her legs. "Sebastian, I think he is in love with me." Sebastian filled his cheeks with air before letting it all loose into the room. "Maldita sea," he said. "Of course he is." In the short term, the only real change was that Sebastian began calling and coming to the shop more frequently than he had before. 4 or 5 times a day he texted, and even if she was busy, she made sure to respond, to reassure him. All was well. Lydia was intensely nervous when Javier came the following week. She texted Sebastian beneath the counter. He's here. I'll call you after. Javier carried a small parcel and his eyes were brighter than usual. He seemed eager for the other customers to withdraw, but Lydia took her time, reluctant to be alone with him. When the last couple wandered toward the exit without any purchases, she called after them. Did you find everything okay? They didn't answer her. The man only nodded, and the bell above the door startled as they left. Lydia's hands trembled as she spooned sugar into Javier's cup. He smiled broadly at her from his stool. I brought a gift. He prodded the paper-wrapped bundle across the counter to her. It was plain brown paper, taped and devoid of ribbons, but the austerity of the wrapping didn't diminish the intimacy of an unwarranted gift on a Wednesday morning. Lydia opened it anyway. Inside was a wooden nesting doll, peanut-shaped and about the length of Lydia's forearm, with a barely visible seam running around her middle. She was painted in festive colors, black hair, pink cheeks, yellow apron, red roses. Lydia pulled her apart at the seam and inside found her identical smaller sister. She pulled her apart again and again, and each time she discovered in miniature the shell of the doll before her. They're Russian nesting dolls, she said. Yes, Javier watched her face. But really, they're me. Keep going. She pulled apart the last severed doll, no taller than her thumb, and inside she found the tiniest sister. This one was bright turquoise and more beautiful, more exquisite and detailed than all the sisters before her. Lydia pinched her between finger and thumb. She held her up and studied the intricate silver filigree of her paintwork. And that's you, Javier tapped his chest with his fist. Muy dentro de mí. Lydia blinked rapidly, but it was too late to conceal the tears that came to the corners of her eyes. Javier mistook them, and his smile broadened. You like them? She sniffed. Very much, thank you. She hastened to pack the dolls back into one another while he watched. He noticed the way she didn't care to line up their tops with their bottoms. This was his first indication that something was truly askew. What's the matter, mi reina? When the dolls were reassembled, Lydia rolled them back into their brown paper and placed them beneath the counter with her phone. There was no easy way to say it. She might as well be direct. I received some bad news last week, she said. He leaned forward, frowning. About you. He leaned back, frowning deeper. A very long silence grew between them, and then a customer came in, jangling the bell above the door. The woman bought three notebooks, three fancy pens, and a birthday card, and Lydia found herself unable to smile while she rang the woman up. She felt Javier's anxiety like a malediction in the room. It rattled into her chest. His shoulders were curled in, and he squeezed his flattened hands between his thighs. When the customer left, Lydia went to the door and locked it. She flipped the sign to Cerrado. They studied each other across the counter. She stared into his eyes, and neither of them shifted their gaze. At length, he spoke. I presumed you knew. His voice was strained, raspy. She shook her head without removing her eyes from his. How would I know? Why would I know? His eyes swam even larger than usual behind the glasses. His mouth trembled as he spoke. It feels as though almost everyone knows, I thought. Somehow, I hoped it didn't matter to you. I thought it didn't matter because you knew me. You could see the person I really am. I can. I still can, she said. But Javier, that other part of you, the part I don't know,
It's irreconcilable. That person is real too, yes?
Finally, he dropped his gaze from hers. He blinked his eyes repeatedly, removed his glasses, and cleaned them on the tail of his shirt.
I love you, he said. I know.
No, you don't. Lydia pressed her lips together. I'm in love with you. I am in love with you. She shook her head. Lydia, you're the only real friend I have, the only person in my life who wants nothing from me except the joy between us.
That's not true.
It is true. And when I'm not with you, I'm lonely for you. You have no idea the light you provide. You and Marta, you're all I really have. Nothing else matters. I would leave it all if I could.
Then do.
She slapped her hand against the counter.
Leave it.
He smiled sadly at her.
It doesn't work that way. It works whatever way you say it works. You're the jefe, right?
Yes, and if I leave, what then? What will become of Acapulco if I leave? How many people will die while they fight over who takes my place? His elbows were up on the counter. He tugged at his hair in distress.
You know I never wanted this. It was an accident of fate that I ended up here.
Quite near the surface of her consciousness, Lydia knew that couldn't really be true. If it was a lottery ticket, it was one he had selected and purchased with his own money. She knew this, that he must have committed specific evils to have attained this rank.
How many? Of what nature?
Some combination of fear and sadness prevented her from asking. She didn't dare to contradict his justifications.
But here we are. Here I am.
His eyes were pleading.
There's no getting out of it, Lydia. Not for me. But it doesn't define who I am.
She could feel the dissonance throbbing through her brain like an erratic pulse.
Of course it defines who you are,
she did not say. She squeezed her eyes shut and felt him take her hand.
Please understand, he said. Try.
When Lydia had found Javier's picture in Sebastian's folder the previous week, she'd been riven with real anguish. Seldom had she experienced such profound and authentic friendship in her life. The prospect of losing that attachment grieved her. But now that Javier sat before her, clasping her hand in his, now that the thing had been spoken between them and confirmed to be true, all that was left for Lydia was autopsy. What love had been there was already slipping away. She could still sense it like a ghost in the room, vague and inanimate, but she could no longer feel it. Her affection had gone, leached out like blood from a cadaver. When he squeezed her fingers, she caught the scent of formaldehyde. When he hooked his sad gaze into hers, she saw the glass of his lenses spattered with blood.
Chapter 9. In Carlos and Meredith's house in Chilpancingo, there are new ghosts to contend with. Trauma waits for stillness. Lydia feels like a cracked egg, and she doesn't know if she's the shell or the yolk or the white. She is scrambled. During the 3 days that follow, she and Luca are often alone in the house while the boys are at school. Carlos is at work, and Meredith prepares the Indiana missionaries for the return home. There is no temporary suspension of living, as there usually is with death, because a public pause would arouse suspicion. Lydia and Luca have to stay hidden. The family has to carry on in their typical fashion. The sons have well-stocked bookshelves in their rooms, gracias a Dios. So while they're out living their regular lives, Luca reads 2 or 3 books a day. Lydia tries to read as well,
but her mind can't hold the words. She doesn't have the reservoir of space to take anything else into her brain. So instead, she tries to keep her body occupied. She cooks food that neither she nor Luca feels like eating. She cleans sinks and laundry and rugs that aren't dirty. She watches as Luca grows silent. The afternoons feel 1,000 hours long. Luca barely even changes positions on the couch as he reads. He moves when he finishes a book. He gets up to retrieve another from the shelf. Whenever he rises to use the bathroom, Lydia tries to coax him into eating. The rest of her time she spends at the old IBM desktop computer that sits on a small cart in one corner of the living room. She checks the headlines coming out of Acapulco. There have been beautiful tributes to Sebastian by his colleagues, but Lydia can't read the reflective pieces. The word hero makes her angry, as if he chose his death courageously, as if it means something. For God's sake, he died with a spatula in his hand. Instead, she skims the news for emerging facts about the investigation, and it's as she expected, nothing. Because fear and corruption work in tandem to censor the people who might otherwise discover the clues that would point to justice. There will be no evidence, no due process, no vindication. So Lydia checks for other stories, new violence, any hint of what's happening among los jardineros. A tourist was accidentally killed in a shootout near the beach huts at Playa Hornos yesterday afternoon. A burned-out car with two bodies inside, one large, one small, was found outside Colonia Loma Larga this morning. The mouse pointer trembles on the screen, but she manages to click out of the news and shift gears. Carlos will get them as far as Mexico City. But what then? She must try to make plans. She researches the buses, and yes, there are reports of increased roadblocks across the area, an uptick in disappearances. Travel within cities is relatively safe, but between cities, it is strongly discouraged. Authorities advise deferring non-essential trips on regional highways in Guerrero, Colima, and Michoacán. Lydia feels a new wave of despair threatening to descend, but she doesn't have time for it. The roads are not an option. Even if her driver's license were current, she wouldn't risk driving with Luca right now, and the buses are no better. The roadblocks are too dangerous. So what's left? She checks airline tickets, although she doesn't love the idea of her name being on a flight manifest. Everything is digital now, and what good will it do to run 1,000 miles away if her name raises a red flag in some online database? Tijuana is about as far as you can get without a passport, and that flight is 3 hours and 40 minutes. Plenty of time for Javier to send a sicario to greet them when they deplane. Lydia imagines carnage at the baggage claim. She can see the headlines. There are no long-distance passenger trains in Mexico, so as a last resort, Lydia studies the freight trains the Central American migrants ride across the length of the country. All the way from Chiapas to Chihuahua, they cling to the tops of the cars. The train has earned the name La Bestia because that journey is a mission of terror in every way imaginable. Violence and kidnapping are endemic along the tracks, and apart from the criminal dangers, migrants are also maimed or killed every day when they fall from the tops of the trains. Only the poorest and most destitute of people attempt to travel this way. Lydia shudders at the YouTube stories, the photographs, the grim warnings delivered by recent amputees. She starts over, researches everything again from the beginning. Buses, planes, trains. There has to be something she hasn't considered. There has to be a way out. She clicks and scrolls and hours pass like sludge while Luca turns page after page. At the dinner table with Carlos and Meredith's 3 boys, Luca wears his father's hat.
and Lydia doesn't demand that he take it off, even when Meredith tells her youngest, no hats at the table. The older boy wipes his milk mustache and grins at Luca, still wearing the Yankees cap.
You like baseball?
The boy asks. Luca only shrugs. He was always a quiet child. As a toddler, Luca never babbled. In fact, he didn't speak at all until he was 4 years old, and by then, Lydia had been panicking for 2 years. She began the practice of reading to him well before she suspected any problem, only because she was a book lover who enjoyed reading aloud to her baby. She liked the idea that, even before he understood them, he might begin with the most beautiful words, that he'd build language from a foundation of literature and poetry. So she started with Márquez and Tolstoy and the Brontes. And eventually, as a result of her growing alarm, she read to him not in the typical way that parents read fairy tales and bedtime stories to their children, but in a frenetic and urgent manner intended to save him. When her fears bloomed and the habit became more concerted, she called upon Paz and Fuentes, Twain and Castellanos. She was fluent in English, too. It had been her minor in college. So sometimes she read Yeats, rendering the lush green of Ireland in her Mexican accent. When Luca was an infant, she brought him to work, tucked into a sling across her chest, and they read together between orders and customers and cleaning and stocking the shelves. Sometimes it was a long while between customers, so the two of them could submerge vividly into their stories. As he grew, he'd sit in a bouncy rocker or on a little playmat she set up for him in the corner behind the register. Eventually, he was free to toddle around the shop, but when it was time to read, he always sat without prompting, cross-legged and silent, head angled to one side, as if creating a funnel for his ear for the words she'd give to him. She tried books with and without pictures, colorful books, tactile books, poetry, photography, art, children's books, cookbooks, the Bible. Her son ran his hands carefully along the glossy or filmy pages, but still, he did not speak. Sometimes she read until her voice gave out, and other days she quickly grew depressed by the solitary sound of herself in the shop. But whenever she wanted to quit, Luca would push the day's book toward her insistently. He'd open it and press it back into her lap. The week before his fourth birthday, as they sat eating pozole at the kitchen table, Lydia lamented their boy's silence for the 100th time. Sebastian balanced his spoon on the edge of his bowl and studied Luca's face. Luca studied him back.
Maybe you don't speak Spanish, Sebastian said in Spanish.
Luca, mimicking his father, balanced his spoon on his bowl too.
That's it, isn't it? Sebastian said.
¿Cuál idioma hablas, mijo?
English? Are you a gabacho?
Wait,
Sebastian snapped his fingers.
You're Haitian.
No,
Arabic.
Tagalo?
Lydia blinked slowly at her husband, but Luca smiled and tried to snap his fingers too. Sebastian showed him how. Click, click, click. Lydia was alone in her desperation. She reasoned that Sebastian must be concerned also, but his dogged optimism prevented him from revealing it. The doctors could find nothing wrong. Lydia felt like screaming. Instead, she patiently continued her efforts. Allende, Borges, Cervantes. She read so that the words she treasured might penetrate her son's solitude. And then one day, as she turned the last unsatisfying page of a short novel by some pretentious young writer, Luca sat up and shook his head. He brushed his hands across his knees. Lydia closed the book and set it on the table beside the rocker where they were seated together.
Luca picked it up and opened it to the first page.
Let's read that one again, please, Mommy. Except this time, let's make it a more agreeable ending.
Perfectly. As if simply continuing a conversation they'd been having his whole life. Lydia was so startled, she nearly hurled him across the room. She pushed him off her lap onto his feet. She turned him around and stared at him.
What?
Luca pressed his lips together.
What did you say?
She gripped his arms at his sides, too roughly perhaps, in her fear that she was coming unhinged.
You spoke, Luca. You spoke?
After a brief and petrifying pause, he nodded.
What did you say?
She whispered.
I would like to read it again.
She clapped both hands onto his cheeks, laughing and crying at once.
Ay, oh my God, Luca!
With a better ending. She crushed him into her chest and squeezed him there. And then she jumped up and took his hands and spun him in a circle.
Say it again. Say something else.
What shall I say?
Exactly that, she'd said. My boy, he speaks.
Lydia closed the shop early that day and took Luca home to perform for his father. She remembers it so clearly. But she doesn't trust that memory now, because the further she gets away from it, the more fanciful it seems. How could he have been so silent for all those years? And then, how could he have started talking like that, like a news anchor, like a college professor, in those beautiful